Hello everyone, Sam Willis here. Now, before we begin, I wanted to make a little announcement. I'm delighted to tell you all that I've teamed up with the excellent Bike Odyssey, a company with history and travel deep in its heart. They offer exceptional biking adventures. Bike Odyssey was set up by the historian, TV presenter and friend of mine, Sam Wood, who made the BBC documentary on Hannibal's Trail, and he subsequently dedicated his life to cycling in the footsteps of great historical figures. This autumn, I'll be joining their Venetians tour, travelling in the footsteps of Marco Polo. Come along and see for yourself why the Adriatic Sea is the most scenic coastline in the world. Along the way, I'll be sharing stories from my life of travel, adventure and research, as well as exploring the history all around us. It'll be a chance not just to immerse yourself in some of the world's most fascinating history, but to change the way that you think about the past. Now, if you want to find out more, just head over to bikeodyssey.cc. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show where we demonstrate that simply everything has its own history, like spiders, Henrys, and grapes.
Or art, depart, and the tart. For me, that's a culinary route that's taking. Or marts, carts, and farts. And we have, in fact, done the history of the fart.
It's one of our most popular podcasts.
It is.
It is.
Well, I think it's the work of Sir Keith Thomas. Which connects very nicely to today's topic. But we will be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Sam, who knew that the history of rubbish is in fact all about truth, secret habits, and fixed wrestling matches? It's also about politics in post-war Britain.
I'm very fond of the history of rubbish.
Yes,
I could write an entire book about the history of rubbish. The man sitting opposite me, he is the hammer and nails of history itself. He's Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. It's James Daybell. Hello, James.
Love it. I like to think of myself as,
a tool.
As Martin Luther. Okay, so the man sitting opposite me is the Thomas Cranmer of Reformation history. He's the man is a genius, but came to a sticky end. It's the famous historical adventurer, the wonderful Dr. Sam Willis.
Hello, James.
Hello, Sam. So you can guess, you can probably guess what we're going to talk about today. But it comes about because we have written a series of books on applying the histories of the unexpected theme to the Romans, the Vikings, and World War II, and also the Tudors. And a couple of weeks back, we released an episode on the Tudors, and we actually thought there's a lot more to say the Tudors. And what we're going to talk about is
the Reformation.
It is the Reformation.
We're going to be talking about the Reformation. It's something that James very often, as regular listeners will know, comes back to.
Reformation and gloves.
This is actually the Reformation podcast you're listening to.
It is. So the Reformation, what is the Reformation? The Reformation is essentially a process, a movement within Western Christianity in the 1500s, so the 16th century, in Europe, whereby the Roman Catholic Church, which was the sort of supreme church across most of Western Christendom, was challenged by reformers who disagreed with various sort of ideas to do with doctrine and also practice. So that's a sort of broad brushstroke definition.
They were like whistleblowers, weren't they? Right at the beginning, they kind of said, this is not right. What's going on here?
So if you have a look at the history of the Christian church, the history of the Christian church has a big tradition of reformists within it. And so people have either what you effectively see is a sort of series of developments in the Christian church where you have new innovations and people sort of then become complacent. So you have new sort of ascetic ideals where people sort of set up monasteries and then they become sort of fat and forget why they're really there and complacent. And then other people who come along and sort of say and want to reform that then lead to a sort of period of reform. Then you get complacency. Then you get reform. So the whole of the history of 2,000 years has largely been that. In the 16th century, we have a watershed moment whereby the universal authority of the church in Rome, and particularly the Pope, is challenged, and it's challenged throughout Europe. In Germany, we have, you know, we have the Peasants' War. You know, we have this kind of this, you know, quite violent and grassroots groundswell sort of opposition to the church in Rome. In England, though, which is largely where we're going to talk about today, because we're talking about the Tudors, it's altogether very different. Now, I want to give you two key ways of thinking about the Reformation in England. Firstly, it is a roller coaster. And secondly, it is an alcohol-free Reformation.
Very good.
Do you want me to explain why?
Yes.
Yes, but...
Let's go with the roller coaster to begin with.
So the roller coaster is rather like what we were talking about earlier on. It is the kind of ups and downs of the Reformation. And rather than just seeing it as a single movement, a single sort of Reformation, you need to think of it in terms of a series of reformations.
Okay.
Plural. So we can distinguish the Henrician Reformation of Henry VIII, which basically saw the split from Rome, the divorce with Catherine of Aragon, the Reformation Parliament from 1529, a series of legislation brought in. And then Henry dies in 1547. His Protestant son takes over, and this is a son, Edward VI, who's been brought up by Protestant tutors, and basically is a devout little thing. And we've got two sort of evangelical, powerful men in the country, in the guise of Protector Somerset and the Duke of Northumberland. And so the Reformation becomes much more reformist, so much more sort of Protestant-leaning. You've also got church figures who sort of fit into this. Thomas Cranmer is the great sort of architect of a lot of this. But then when Mary comes to the throne, as I think we talked about a few weeks ago, the country swings back. And so we have a Catholic revival. Then when Elizabeth comes to the throne again in 1558, we have the 1559 Elizabethan settlement, which basically puts all the sort of reformist stuff back on the statute books. So rather than thinking of it as simply, you know, Henry VIII comes in and everyone is, you know, the country becomes Protestant, there are sort of ups and downs. And in fact, what happens is when Elizabeth comes in, what happens is you get a definition of an Anglican church, so of one single church that everyone suddenly has to sort of adhere to. And the problem is that that framework isn't as flexible, actually, as the Catholic Church once was, which was a church for everyone. This sort of laid down more or less what you should do. And it didn't fit the Catholics and it didn't fit the Puritans. And so what you have is a splintering of religion. So there's the roller coaster. Alcohol-free?
Hit me with alcohol-free.
Alcohol-free. Alcohol-free is basically to distinguish the Reformation in England from the Reformation on the continent. As I talked about earlier on, the Reformation on the continent is a really sort of violent Reformation. Look at what's happening in France and the French Wars of Religion. You look at what's happening in Germany and you've got uprisings. In England, it's actually a pretty peaceful Reformation. It's a Reformation from above. And this idea of it as an alcohol-free Reformation is not my idea. This, when I was an undergraduate at Oxford, I sat through the wonderful Christopher Haig's lectures on Reformation history. And he referred to it as the alcohol-free Reformation because it was just, you know, it just sort of went through. It was almost Reformation by clockwork. And talking to his wife about this, the reason that he came up with this idea, his wife is Australian, the reason that he came up with this idea was from watching alcohol-free beer adverts in Australia. That's it.
That's amazing.
Isn't it amazing? Alcohol-free?
I think I don't understand it. As in, it's not...
So it's not a full... So basically, we're, if you have a look at what happened on the continent is a...
So it's a version that's less spiky.
It's alcohol free in that it's less full bodied.
Okay.
Basically the Reformation on the continent is a grassroots groundswell. People want a new religion and rebel because of it. In England, the old tradition was that Protestantism was pretty popular.
Yeah.
Anti-clericalism, so a hatred of the clergy, seeing the church as full of abuses and basically unfit for purpose, was the traditional view. This was A.G. Dickens. A generation of historians that's around Chris Haig's generation came in and brought in a sort of new revisionist interpretation of the Reformation, which said, actually, it wasn't that popular. It's a Reformation from above. And actually, it took a hell of a long time to come in. Even once you've got the 1559 Protestant settlement on the statute books, what's actually happening in the parishes, people are more or less able to do exactly what they want. And so it's not until the 1580s when you have a university-educated clergy who are in the parishes. So it's alcohol-free.
Yeah, that's excellent. The entire scope of what it's influenced and affected is kind of mind-boggling.
Mm.
And we could do an entire unexpected history of the Reformation itself. And I can tell you right now that it would include shadows.
Yes. Ooh, yes.
It would include perfume. It would include beards.
Yes, yes.
Think of all the popes with their beards, the post-Reformation people. It would include clocks.
Yes.
Protestant time. What do we mean by that?
Well, Protestant work ethic. So the work ethic is that you have to sort of attend to your... There's a Weberian concept that, that as a Protestant work ethic is that you are mindful about what you do and keep track of the time.
It's also all about beds, deathbeds.
Yes.
It's all about spying.
It's about diaries.
Is it?
Yes, it's all about diaries. So the idea is that basically you have to account for yourself in spiritual terms, and with the Reformation, we see a rise in spiritual diaries. So often, sort of puritanical diaries, people writing to basically account for all the things that they are doing in their lives. We've talked in the past about Lady Margaret Hoby's diary.
Yeah.
Remember when we looked at that and basically her diary? This is a gentlewoman living at the end of the 16th, start of the 17th century, living in Yorkshire, and kept a diary of her day-to-day life where she basically gets up, has breakfast, prays, goes out and does some stuff, comes back, prays, talks, prays. You know, so it's literally what regiments her life. But in our book on the Tudors, The Unexpected History of the Tudors, there are four different ways that the Reformation comes into the story. The history of bones.
Yep.
The history of windows, the history of bells, and the history of fire are all little ways into looking at the Reformation.
Should we take one of those?
Bones.
Okay.
The bones. So bones is all about relics.
Bones and saints and relics.
And saints and relics. And, you know, as part of the late medieval church, or the medieval church, bones of saints and pilgrimages to go and see them, you know, were an important part of that kind of Christian practice, a Christian worship. And
have you ever seen a bone of a saint?
I've kissed a bone of a saint.
Have you really?
Yes. I've done all that sort of... Yes, of course.
Where?
If you go in church.
Where?
They'll bring things up. They'll bring things up.
England?
I have actually... In England, yes.
Okay.
In England.
Well, you're a historian. Were you like, this is preposterous. This is not a saint's bone. This is from a sparrow.
As a young boy, I was brought up Catholic, and it was the kind of thing that you sort of did.
And you believe?
You believe that it was actually the bone of a saint.
I mean,
as a small boy, you're presented with something, and you sort of do it.
Yeah.
And you know, the Catholic world is full of those kinds of things. As a skeptical academic and everything, I you know, one wouldn't wish to sort of preach about these things. But if you have a look at the preface to Christopher Haig's book, The English Reformations, he talks there about the religious journey that he's had spiritually, and has gone through sort of periods of strong belief to agnosticism to atheism. And I think a lot of academics do that. You know, who knows where I am now? I'm certainly not going to announce that on a podcast.
the idea of relics in the Reformation is actually really important, isn't it? Because one of the things that I've come across that becomes a relic of the Reformation itself is where it all began.
Ooh.
It's the door upon which Luther took his hammer and nails, and
it could be about doors, posting.
He nailed his theses, which I said to my son, he thought I said he nailed his feces,
yes,
to a door.
I thought you would say that.
He nailed his theses to a door.
Very careful with pronunciation there.
Nailed his theses to a door. And these are various arguments he wanted to pick and discuss. He did this in October 1517. Anyway, I'll talk about this a bit later, but the door becomes a relic. And it is drawn as such, is illustrated as such.
Where is it?
It was burnt down in the mid-18th century.
Right.
It's been replaced by one. There's an amazing one that there now, but it's a replacement of the original.
Right.
But there is a particularly interesting 18th century engraving of that door on that church of a tourist essentially there. So he's a well-dressed man. He's standing, yes, in front of the door. This is in 1715, so 202 years after it happened, and he's just gesturing up towards the door. And there's another man standing next to him with a big stick, also pointing at the door. And so they're on a door safari around Northern Europe.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Anyway, it's interesting. And there is also belief that for a while, the actual nails with which he had hammered his theses onto the door were still there. And people were going to look at the nails which were attached to it. So there is even a...
So that's kind of like a sort of Protestant pilgrimage, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
It is. But, I mean, back to bones. Bones are still very much part of Catholic worship. And if you go to, you know, Rome or you go to Italy, you know, saints' bones are, you know, are everywhere. Of course, reformers, reformers within the church. So Erasmus, the Dutch humanist, so he's somebody who's still very much a Catholic, but criticizing it from within, is very critical of this kind of practice. When Henry VIII dissolves the monasteries, one of the things that the people who are going into the monasteries and, you know, stripping the assets are doing is they're confiscating the bones, and in some cases they're smashing them up. And so bones are about conflict between, you know, different sort of religious views.
Mm.
Windows.
Before that, I want to carry on my doors. I'm going to intersperse my doors idea.
Intersperse your doors.
We've been doing this for so long now, you jumped on exactly what I was going to talk about, which
did
is
I?
Slightly disappointing.
What was that?
Well, do you know who Thomas Bennett is?
Thomas Bennett?
Just have a big think. Think 1531, James. He was an Exeter schoolmaster.
Yes, I do. Yes.
Thomas Bennett, the Exeter schoolmaster in October 1531. Right, he had some beef. And he was a bit of denouncing of the veneration of the saints, and the Pope was an antichrist.
Yes.
And he printed some stuff.
Yes.
Do you know what he did with it?
He ate it?
He hammered it onto the door of Exeter Cathedral.
Did he know?
With some nails.
Did he know?
He absolutely did. Now, here's another one. This is really interesting.
Yes, go on.
May 1570.
Yes.
Papal excommunication of Elizabeth I.
Yes.
That was nailed onto a door. You're amazed by this, aren't you?
I can see. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Bishop of London's Palace near St. Paul's Cathedral. I've got about 20 other examples.
No, go on, go through them.
Do you want to go through all of them?
No, well, not necessarily all of them. My friend...
In 1521, James.
Yes, yes, yes.
The authorities in Antwerp, became furious because a lot of Lutheran supporters had hammered with nails ballads and libels onto church doors and archways. That's 1521.
So it's four years after. It's very common practice. My friend, my very good friend, Andrew Gordon. Andrew, if you're listening to this, happy 50th birthday. He's written about the conscripting of public space. So this idea that if you want to get ideas around, propaganda around, you want to preach your word, you know, and you don't have access to printing presses, which you wouldn't have because they're all controlled, how do you get that? How do you get that out? Well, you put it out in prominent places, and a cathedral door would be a prominent place. A marketplace would be a prominent place.
There's a whole history of fascinating. It's really interesting. Yep. Notice boards there.
Yeah, yeah.
But this, I really like. The irony of this is beautiful.
Go on.
So when the Pope excommunicates Luther, what happens? They print off the excommunication. Everyone hammers it onto their church doors. That's brilliant.
It's great. It's great. I mean, this actually speaks to us about the, and I'm sure we've talked about this before, the church is an instrument of the state. So the church is somewhere where everybody goes along to or is supposed to go along to. And if you want any kind of message brought across, where do you do it? Where everyone goes. So, you know, so the pulpit, certainly post Elizabeth I in England, the pulpit suddenly becomes a way of getting out, you know, state propaganda, if we can talk about it like that. And one of the ways that you do it is not necessarily through the printed word or the written word, but it's through sermons and through public prayer, the printing of public prayers that would be read out, that would announce the victory over the Armada. How would people know that the Armada was defeated? Go to church on a Sunday.
Here's another thing to think about.
Go on, toss it over.
See if you can guess where this is going to go. The sound of the nails entering the wooden frame was not unlike the sound of nails being driven into a...
coffin.
Cross.
A cross. Oh, okay.
You with me?
Okay.
So yes. There's all sorts of hammer and nail stuff going on.
Goodness me.
It's really interesting. And also, it's all about doors. The church at the time, by hammering on his 95 theses on the door and by questioning what the church was doing, a lot of people later argued he was essentially allowing Jesus back into the church. And so the doorway becomes a way of allowing goodness back into the church, back into this public body. And that is the same history as devil's doors. Do you know what a devil's door is?
No, tell me about devil's door.
You need to go to a lovely church near Totnes, near us. Huh. The Church of St. Peter and St. Paul is an example of a church with a devil's door. So most churches are built on the north-hand side of a road. So the south door faces the sun. It's nice and means the north door is kind of hidden. And it was all at a time when they were built at a time when there were also pagan believers attending church. Anyway, they started building small, like little hobbit doors, essentially, on the north wall of walls of churches. And it's all to do with people following different religions, but within the same building. And also, it allows the devil... Yep. Now, this is where you're going to come around.
The devil in or the devil out?
Out, which is a bit like a corpse door and the Vikings. Yes. So what happens when you get baptised?
Yes.
You are flushed of the devil.
Yes.
But you're doing it in a church.
So the devil needs to go.
The devil needs to go somewhere.
Love it.
And so they have a door... outside,
is there a shoe outside the devil, door?
There might be a shoe outside the door.
A shoe outside the door to catch the devil.
It's all to do with spirits going in and out of buildings as well. It's genuinely amazing, the Reformation. And we haven't even started talking about all the other stuff we can talk about.
You should all go and study the Reformation. It's truly brilliant. Miracles, angels, you know, all sorts. The natural world, all sorts.
And of fire as well.
And fire.
We were talking about how do you discover news of the Armada, whatever it was. You go and look on your church door. You look on your notice boards.
Yes,
it's actually worth thinking about how everyone did it as well. So it's actually a massive social network.
Yes.
So It's like a retweet or a like.
Social media.
So he's hammering up his 95 theses, and someone else is taking that and then reprinting it and creating 1,000 copies of that, gives it to someone else who reprints it, creates 1,000 copies of that, and so on.
I can't help but think that all those windows on Hardwick Hall are more about Bess of Hardwick just wanting a bit of bling. This is a woman who had her initials sort of inscribed across the architectural space of this property.
Yeah. I like the idea with all of the window smashing that's going on. Is you've got some people who realise there's going to be window smashing in the very foreseeable future, and they take their windows away.
Yes.
And they look after them. They kind of store them for safety. And then when all the window smashing has happened, even though it's still post-Reformation, they put them back up.
Yes. And also, I mean, it doesn't happen everywhere, because there are those people. I mean, it's actually quite expensive to reglaze windows in churches to keep the drafts out. So that it's happening in certain parts of the country at this time, and other parts it's not. So it's a kind of an index of, I suppose, of how Protestant the country, if we can use a term like Protestant in this period. Fire. You brought up fire.
Yes, so that's another way of communicating, isn't it? So we've got communicating by smashing windows, which is one fairly punchy way of saying what you believe in. But the Tudors were communicated using fire all the time.
It's all And also, it was a way of burning people, burning heretics, was an important part of the Reformation, and it tended to be, you know, those who were reformist or who were Protestants who were burned, not just in Mary's reign, but during the reign of Henry VII, 24 heretics were burned, 81 in the reign of Henry VIII. There are only two in the 6 years of Edward VI's reign, only two burnings. But Mary was the one who really embraced burning. And during this five-year reign, almost 300 men and women, many of them very ordinary, but some of them very high profile, were burned for being Protestants. This is nothing compared to what's going on the continent with the Inquisition in Catholic Spain. An estimated 150,000 people were persecuted and several thousand executed. And the reason, for Catholics, the reason that you burn people rather than do anything else is that you have a bloodless death, which is the best sort of salvation for the soul, supposedly.
And is this supposedly part of the Counter-Reformation? So the Reformation happens, then the Catholics go hard line.
Okay. So, I mean, what happens is, the Counter-Reformation is fascinating, because what happens is the late medieval church is really a Gladstone bag of an institution. It is, you know, it's something for everyone, you know, and the church is open to all sorts of people within the community. It's a real sort of focal point of all sorts of things. It plays a really important role. So while there are definitions of who are heretics and who aren't, there isn't really, you're not facing, national churches that you have to. So it's not a sort of state battle of the state, and not a battle that sort of crosses over sort of geographical boundaries. You're dealing with isolated groups of people that you're putting down. As soon as the Reformation comes around, you suddenly need to define what Catholic doctrine is and Catholic practice, and bring about a way of defending yourself against reformers. And so the Counter-Reformation is basically set up not only doctrinally, but also in terms of the infrastructure, in order to be able to get your own house in order and go out. This is when we find the Jesuits, coming into being. So the Jesuit priests are this kind of important educational elite force who then suddenly set up a series of schools around Europe.
Yeah, and they're persecuted and hunted. People.
Persecuted and hunted.
They appear in our history of holes we've done.
They do, yes.
Because they hide.
They do, yes.
Hide in holes. And while we're talking about the Counter-Reformation, that is the link with beards, because there's Sixtus V.
Yes.
Very famous. Just Google Vatican Museum's portrait of Sixtus V if you buy a computer, and you'll notice he has a truly excellent beard, and became a really important visual image of the Counter-Reformation. I sense we could go on for hours, but we should probably wrap things up.
Bells?
Let's just say we can't leave people hanging.
Bells
again about communication.
The bells are about communication. So one of the ways in which you look at popular adulation for rulers are the force with which, the enthusiasm with which bells were rung. And supposedly Mary was greeted with, widespread peals of bells. Elizabeth also, so we can see that they were, at that sort of level, at that sort of index, they're popular monarchs. But also the bell in the during the service was a really important part of pre-Reformation, late medieval church and their mass. And particularly during the Eucharist, so when you're receiving the bread and wine, the body and blood of Christ, the bell would be rung. So in particular, the sacring bell, and that was banned by reformers, but what replaced it was instead a sermon bell, so a different kind of reformist bell. So, fascinating, huh?
All sorts of different changes.
Ghosts, werewolves. The Reformation is all about those. Different attitudes towards them. Fairies as well.
Well, what we're going to do is, in the coming few weeks, we're going to carry on doing what we're doing now, which is we are doing unexpected takes on well-known subjects.
Yes.
So we've done our Tudors, Romans, World War II, and
Vikings.
The Vikings, and we've done the Reformation. We're going to do highwaymen. We've done pirates. We're going to do highwaymen. We're going to do secret codes. We're going to do spies. We're going to do treasure. We're going to do Nazis. We're going to just sort of romp through, aren't we? Doing all sorts of fun stuff. All brilliant fun, but with a couple of traditional, just focused on unexpected subjects coming up. James mentioned to me the idea of doing footsteps before
brilliant.
We came in. It's a truly wonderful thing. And I have been meaning to do a podcast on walking backwards for so long, and I'm going to make us doing it because I've got in touch with an amazing artist, and she's made a film about walking backwards, and we're going to watch the film and we're going to talk about her and her work, but I'm not going to tell you any more until we actually do it.
I'd like to do volcanoes.
Let's do volcanoes.
We haven't done dinosaurs.
Oh, and we're also going to do geographical stuff. So we're going to do the unexpected history of Devon.
We are. Yes.
Yeah, we thought we'd start here. If you own a county, do get in touch.
If you own a county, a church, a castle, a date, a family, if you're royal, you own a country, run a country.
But
get
we're starting
in touch.
With counties. So we're going to do Devon. If you'd like us to do your county, give us a shout. We'll get in touch with the local museum and see what they've got, and we can see what we can knock up. I'd like to do Yorkshire, but not as much as I want to do Cornwall because it's closer.
No, not as much as I'd like to do gloves.
Oh, okay.
And it's nothing to do with counties, but I am relocating my obsession with historical handwear.
Why is that?
Because I'm writing a book at the moment on the history of gloves. So I'm obsessed. The other day, Sam, you get this, I decided that I would write a book on gloves before Christmas. And so what did I do? I went home and organised a bookshelf. It's got notes one end and really interesting things to read. And I wrote some of it down.
Brilliant.
I got very excited.
Anchoring it in history with your writing.
Exactly.
Please refer to previous podcast for that one to make any sense to you at all. Thank you all very much for listening. You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Sam Willis. And actually, can you please listen to us? If you're listening to us on iTunes, leave a review. If you're listening to us anywhere, leave a review. It really massively helps spread the word. James and I are trying to do something new. We're trying to do something quite difficult. And it's time-consuming, it's fun, but we can't get anywhere without all of your support and help. So do please show us the love where you can.
Yes, and on Twitter, in the Twitter sphere, you can follow me at James Daybell, and you can follow Histories of the Unexpected at Unexpected Pod.
All live shows, all books, all information, everything is on historiesoftheunexpected.com. Do please check in there. Thank you all so much for listening. Once more, guys, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.